March 7th, 2007, is the Watt from Pedro Show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, that was John Coltrane with Crescent from his Live in Japan record, his last tour. And we're broadcasting here from Crans, Montana, Switzerland. I have the immense pleasure and honor to have Mr. Steve McKay, Mr. Scott Ashton joining me here at a, what's it called? Hotel Park?
Hotel Du Parc.
Hotel Du Parc. And first time I ever done a remote Watt from Pedro show, so this is an exciting thing for me here. You want to say hi, Steve?
Hey there.
Scotty?
Yo.
Yeah. So yesterday we did a bunch of TV in Paris, France. What'd you think of that?
It was good. People loved it. It was rocking. And, everything went well. And, we had a good time.
What'd you think, Steve?
Well, I didn't get to play yesterday. I got to sit around and watch a lot. For the day before yesterday, I got to play a bunch of songs.
Yeah.
And that was fun. Yeah, so I would have rather been there not playing than hanging out sulking in my hotel room.
Okay. Okay. I think that was some first TV stuff we did with Stooges, like that, where we go in the studio. Huh?
Yeah, that was the first race, man.
Yeah. I mean, we've had people tape our gigs, right, and put them on TV. But that's the first time where we
did
like
MTV Serbia and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, in Australia, the big day out. Right. I think they did the whole Sydney show.
Oh, it's happened a lot of times, yeah.
Yeah. This first time where we're like prepped just for the event.
We never see it. We did the Henry Rollins show. Did you see
that's
it?
Right. No, it don't come out till maybe this month or the next. That's right. In December, we did Hank Rollins.
You did.
Yeah, Steve wasn't there, unfortunately. Oh, and the MTV thing. We did this BAM wedding reception.
BAM's Unholy Union.
And Steve McKay was there for that.
Yes, I was. Thank you, Iggy.
Okay. Oh, that's right. What was that about? That was a last minute thing, huh?
Yeah, and it was cool because we got to kind of get a paid rehearsal of some of the new songs from the new record, The Weirdness. And I got to play on more songs than I did on the album, and we had a good time.
Yeah, but I don't think that's been aired yet, right? You said you watched it and he was getting his Christmas tree?
Yeah, and that was last week, so.
So he's way behind?
It's going to be on in a couple of weeks or something, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, they have to go through the bachelor party first.
What was another first about that BAM gig?
Another first about the BAM.
Yeah, concerning the Stooges.
It was a wedding. We were the wedding band.
Yeah? Oh, you're right. But there was another thing.
What was that?
Bass player was in a boiler suit.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watch the new first look.
The new outfit. Boiler suit.
I want one.
Yeah.
It can be matching bookends.
And what's your reply to that? You're in T-shirts now, right?
Well, since you had to stop wearing T-shirts or chose to stop wearing T-shirts.
No, I got a call from Meg.
Somebody has to do it. It's a dirty job, but someone has to do it.
You tucking them in?
Nope.
We don't tuck them in. And black is really flattering for me. I'm not the skinny guy I used to be.
Is that true?
That's true.
I know. Ronnie told me he used to be very svelte, supple, and willowy.
Very, very.
You ran track.
Yeah. Cross country, too. I was a star. It was because there wasn't any balls, and nobody was trying to hit me, at least overtly, or knock me down, so. It's been a while since I ran a mile.
Yeah, what changed?
I don't know. I can't blame it on the music. But
was it after coming to Cali?
Yeah, I kept it up for a while after I moved out here.
Because you're originally from Grand Rapids?
Yeah. Yeah, I moved out to California in 77.
But in between was Ann Arbor.
Well, before, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and I went to University of Michigan and spent more time working at the record store and playing in bands than I did in class, but
that's exactly what Jim did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then stayed on for too long, and played with Mojo Boogie Band for about 5 years, and then bailed on that, and things were getting a little rough around there.
Ah, you were in Cali a little bit, though, for the Funhouse record, huh?
Yeah, for like 6 weeks or something. I used to live in California when I was like in kindergarten and stuff. I was a sort of a Navy brat.
Ah.
So you know about that, don't you?
No, I know about that.
Are you saying your pop was a sailor?
My pop was a pilot. He was a carrier pilot.
In the Navy, but a flyboy.
Yeah, except he got really lucky. If you ever have to get into a war, make sure that you pick something that takes a really long time to train for. Because he entered in 43, and when he got his wings was December of 45. So all they had to do was go out and watch atomic bombs go off at Bikini and things like that.
Yes, totally. Well, we're at the end of the first hour. March 7, 2007, Watt Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. March 7, 2007, is Watt from Pedro Show, second hour. Here's some Steve McKay. That was Steve McKay with Face Up on Dash. Steve, you want to tell us something about that tune there? Who played on it?
Let's see. We had myself and a guy named Melvin Ocasio. I think he's from L.A., I'm not sure. And a guy named Fabrizio Palumbo, otherwise known as R., who is from Torino in Italy.
Yeah.
And we got together at the studios of KFJC.
In Los Altos.
In Los Altos.
NorCal.
NorCal, volunteer radio station.
Great station.
And they're on the web.
Right.
They've got a sister station with WFMU in New York. And this is part of a...
Well, New Jersey, I think.
Yeah, New Jersey. Metro New York. But yes, exactly.
Much respect to New Jersey.
Jersey City, if you want to get specific. Yeah. That's fine. But yeah,
I played live on the air there.
Yes, I have.
Ryan Turner. I have too.
A couple different times, yeah.
Good cat.
Absolutely. And this was on the Dominic Trix show. And it was with part of a collective that I play with called the Radon Ensemble.
Yeah, tell us about that.
That's like an international collective of, I don't know, largely noise music people. So I'm sort of like the voice in the wilderness, being on the saxophone. Although I try to, sometimes there's effects and sometimes there's some squawking and things like that. And, oh gosh, we recorded that a few years ago.
What's the tune about?
Well, we kind of like make these songs up, and then later on we figure out what the titles are. And this title was from When You Park in the Parking Lot. The parking ticket says this on it. But I thought it sounded kind of interesting and sort of like, what would you be doing with your face up on the dash? I don't know. What kind of a car was it? Sometimes that's for the back seat.
Yeah. But, so you improvised it and then titled it later.
Yeah, that's what we usually do.
Right.
So we come up with all kinds of things. This is from my CD called Steve McKay, Michigan and Arcturus.
Ah, new album.
Yeah, which is available on Radon Records. And you can get in touch with them at radoncollective.org.
Spell it.
RADONCOLLECTIVE.ORG.
Yeah. So go there. Check it out. Get Steve McKay CD.
Yep. And we've played in various combinations all over the United States and in many portions of Europe.
Right, right. In fact, you did a Tennessee tour?
I did a mini Tennessee tour, and then we did another one last year about this time where we started out in Nashville and worked our way down to Atlanta and then all the way up to Boston and finished off in Brooklyn with a recording session.
Great.
Yeah.
Who's the ringleader?
Scott Neidiger.
Yeah.
And
how many members are there of your band?
Well, we have like, I guess I'm now one of the core members of all this, but there are, I don't know, 10 or 15 people like that, and then we have other people we're kind of associated with.
Do you guys take on new members? Or?
Well, yeah, all the time.
Some drop off?
Some drop off, yeah. Some break up, some end up in Turkish prison.
Over the side.
Unfortunately, but yeah.
Interesting concept. Right down.
Yeah, I really like it. It's been giving me a lot of interesting stuff to do.
How long you been with it?
Boy, it's been about 5 years now.
5 years?
At least, yeah.
And what number CD is this for Steve McKay?
I guess this is the second one.
Second?
Yeah, the first one is called En Voyage, and that's a little bit harder to find. That's like old studio tracks and more kind of like rock and roll songs.
And
like
then that. There was some vinyl?
Oh, after Michigan and Arcturus came out, another one came out on the Cubico label, and that's in vinyl only. And I think he only makes about 500 at a time. But if you go to eBay, you can see if you can get one.
Yeah.
We may put that out on CD. We've got permission to do so. That one's called Tunnel Diner.
Right.
And that's some stuff from 2004. And most of it was actually from last year, 2006. And that's stuff from Portland and... that stuff from Marseille in France and
Porto.
I don't know if there's any Portuguese. Yeah, I think there's some Portuguese stuff on there too. Yeah, Porto.
So the other members of Radon, do they also put out their own material?
Oh, they certainly do. Yep, and they're out there with their little merch tables at, you know, clubs, well known or not. Around the world.
Yeah. Right. And there's Italian folks too, right?
Yeah, we've got a branch in Torino, and we got people in Milano.
You played with the Zoo Cats?
Yeah, I've got to go out with them in 2005 for we played in Slovenia, and we played in Italy, and we played in Vienna, and I ended up doing about, I don't know, 10 days on the road with those guys, and that was a real honor.
Marcel?
Yeah.
I got to play with them in Silver Lake on DOS at Spaceland. Great band.
Oh, I love it. It's like a mostly Barry sax, bass, and drums.
Right. But didn't you do a gig with three saxes?
We've done gigs with more saxes than that. I think we did one in with Radon. We did one in Chicago at the what was that?
Empty Bottle.
Yeah, the Empty Bottle in Chicago last fall, and we had four at that point.
Wow,
that was great.
Wasn't there a notorious picture of people displaying the bells?
The bells.
Yeah, like they lifted up their shirts.
Oh, that was from Portugal, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you had the baby bell.
As it turned out, as we know from what that means middle-aged guys' beer guts. And that was an international effort. One of them was Argentinian, one was Czech, and one was Yankee me, so.
Right, but you had the baby bell.
I was surprised.
So you got some work cut out for you.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to work in the opposite direction, but I'm kind of holding the line right now.
Okay.
At about 80 kilograms. So do your math, right?
You got future plans for Radon?
Yeah. I heard that Nidegger was going to set me up and send me down to Austin in the next couple of months. So he had some people down there. And I'll probably be one of those things where
Texas.
where I blow into town and meet some band I never met before and make music with them. But
right.
I'm kind of used to that. So.
Well, you'll also be there at the Stooges.
Well, we're going to be there much sooner.
St. Patrick's Day.
All three of us and the rest of the guys.
All right, right.
For right. South by Southwest.
Yeah. Can we talk about Stooges? Scotty, can you talk about how the band started?
Yeah, I was playing drums with Gary Quackenbush. He was a member of the SRC band, Dan Arbor. And what we would do
is,
it would be 67. And we'd sit around with John Mayles and the Blues Breaker album and listen to it and then try to copy it, just the two of us, guitar player and drums. So
No bass.
And so, you know, I was just messing around. So people were coming over to the house. Bob Seger would come over. Glenn Fry would come over. And, you know, all the locals, they were just getting their start. They'd come over and hang out. And, you know, we'd talk music. And was very, very much interested in being in a band. And then one day, my brother Jim came over one evening and said, we're starting a band, and we want you to be in it. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. So,
but you met Iggy previous?
I had met him through my brother. My brother played bass in the Prime Movers. And,
that's Ron, right?
Yeah. And Jim worked at Discount Records like Steve.
Yeah, I think I got his job, at least a couple people afterwards.
Vivian worked there. And,
Bob Schaff.
Bob Schaff worked there.
Where was it?
Some right corner downtown? Of State and Liberty. Yeah, right on the campus, U of N campus.
Does it no longer exist?
It's still there.
No, they tore it down 2 years ago. A friend of mine was back there for something, and he gave me a picture and said, there it is. It was still, and then a week later, it was gone.
Oh, Raven?
Yeah.
So, anyhow, me and Dave and Ron used to go up in the afternoons and stand out in front of the store looking like we were a rock and roll band.
Dave Alexander.
And we had a little band we were starting, we called the Dirty Shames. And we weren't very good, and we would play along with an album of the Byrds' first album. While it was playing. And our best number was the Bells of Rhythm.
Oh, yeah, good tune.
We take the phone down the basement in case someone called and there was a party. We didn't want to miss that. And Dave came up with the name Dirty Shames. One of the W.C. Fields movies.
Yeah.
It's just very, very briefly, he's walking into a saloon and they flash the camera of the name of the saloon. It's the Dirty Shame Saloon. So he said, Dirty Shame, that's a good name for a band. So we were basically kind of pretending we were a band and hanging out, loving all the music, you know, because at that time, at that age, that's all we wanted to do. You know, that's all I ever thought about. That's all I ever cared about.
How old were you?
At that time, I was 16. And when Ron and Jim came over to the house that day, I was 17. And so we just started getting together. I kind of got out of that band house I was living in. And we just started going at it, you know, something totally different than anything else you'd ever heard in your life. And I always say, if that band that we originally had started was here today, it would be as much interest as any other band out there now. So we worked for about a year, year and a half.
Did you come up with the name of the band right away?
Well, not right away. We were had been living in the same house for a while, and there was this chemical going around. It's called LSD. And I was kind of afraid of it. I wasn't sure what it was and if I ever did want it. But I picked up a manager, Ron Richardson, and he said he loved it. He used to go to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist would give it to him. And he'd sit and talk to the psychiatrist while he was tripping. So he came over one day and goes, here, guys, you got to try this. And I'm going, I think I'm going to wait till I'm 18. And I was only 17. I said, I'll wait till I'm 18. I ended up taking it that night. So we're all like just totally stumbling around, tripped out of our brains. We ended up in my bedroom, which had like French windows that both sides opened up. My bed was up against the window. We're all three standing on my bed, looking out the window, kind of bouncing around, bumping into each other. I think it was Ron who said, yeah, we're kind of like the Three Stooges on acid. Yeah. And then we said, hey, yeah, I said, the Psychedelic Stooges. Yeah, that's the name of the band. Which later we had to drop because Elektra Records didn't like the word psychedelic. But basically, that's how it started, is just hanging around, just wanting to be in a band and being fortunate enough to be in contact with the right people.
And now you were playing some unique drum.
Well, we started off like with the drum set, but we want to get came closer to the time where we knew, well, we're going to have to start doing performances. We're going to have to
gigs.
Have gigs. He says, well, we better do something really, really different. So as Jim came up with the idea, well, you can use these 50-gallon oil drums that I found on this farm. And Dave painted them day glow with the sign of Ohm on the head of one of them. And we took a black light and put it on the day glow paint and made the sign of Ohm shine up in the night, in the dark. And put a viola contact mic right on the oil drum itself. And with a wood drum beater, when I stomped on that drum beater, you never heard anything like that in the world. People didn't know what to think. They didn't know what to do. They don't know, do we like this? Do we hate it?
What was Iggy playing?
Iggy was playing a Hawaiian guitar. He had made a wig out of a woman's bathing cap where he took strips of aluminum foil and stapled them all over the hat, all over the cap, so he had like an aluminum foil wig. He shaved his eyebrows off, and he took baby oil and rubbed it all over his face, and then took handfuls of glitter and threw it in his face. He was wearing a female's tutu with one golf shoe.
Is there a male tutu?
I don't think so. And then he one golf shoe, and he had a piece of metal, a piece of sheet metal on the floor of the stage. And he put a mic down to the sheet metal, and during the song he would stomp on that with his golf shoe, which created another "What the hell is that?" And
what was Dave playing?
Dave was at the very beginning picking up a box bass head with the reverb turned all the way up and dropping it onto the speaker cabinet, creating this huge crash. I guess we were probably the first noise band.
I think so.
Yeah.
Was this
after Harry Parch?
Was this practice or was this the first gig?
That was first gig.
And where was it at?
Grandy Ballroom. We had did a little showing at a Halloween party at our manager that we ended up blowing every fuse in the house, so we only played for about 10 minutes. But our very first live professional show was the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. And that's where the oil drums and the tutus and the crash in the bass amp and the Hawaiian guitar through a fuzz box cranked as loud as could get on a big box amp.
What was Roddy playing?
Roddy was playing bass. Fuzz tone bass with a wah-wah.
Now, how many songs was there?
Well, we didn't really have songs. We had like motifs, and it was ready, steady, go. Where it went, how it changed, what it did was different every time. Where it ended, how it ended was different every time. And
lyrics,
mostly just moaning or groaning or kind of screaming. We tried to work one song up as a Jane American song called She Cried.
Oh, yeah.
And Jim actually sang the words, "When I told her I didn't love her anymore, she cried." But it sounded nothing like Jane American, She Cried. You wouldn't have known that it was Jane American, She Cried, if you didn't hear those words. But other than that, you know, it was just basically, what do we feel like playing? Let's just start playing. You know, we had no songs. It wasn't until Electra Record label deal came along where they said, "We love you guys, we love Iggy. You guys are really different, you're really cool, but you have to have some songs."
What was the reaction at that first gig from the audience?
A lot of jaws were dropped. A lot of people were sneering. The girls were just loving Jim because he had this attraction of females that was just unbeatable. And
people would say, God, that was, what was that? That was terrible, man. Next time we played, those exact same people would be there. So I think it became kind of a thing where people like to dislike us, and they like to come and see us so they could yell and jeer and see Iggy, because not once did he ever do a show that was anything similar to the show before. So it was always like a one-time happening performance.
You guys would have been really good on Radon, as a matter of fact. You if that band existed today, that's the label that would you'd be on.
When was the first time you saw him, Steve?
I saw him. I guess it was 1968, and at that point, they had titles for songs like "Dance for Romance" and "Asthma Attack." Things like that.
Dog food.
Living on dog food. But the first time I saw them, they had more like regular instruments, except Jimmy Silver was their manager then, and instead of the 50 gallon oil drum, he had like a 200 gallon home heating oil drum. Painted
the
with
wood beater sound like a man.
No, he was playing it with a 5-pound sledgehammer. He was playing it with a 5-pound sledgehammer, and instead of the ohm sign, they had everyone in the band's astrological glyphs painted on the oil tank. Yeah, and that was always fun seeing them. I saw them at Union Ballroom in Ann Arbor, and we would see them down at the Grandy Ballroom. Sometimes I would be in a band that would be playing there.
Yeah, who would you open up for?
Mostly, a lot of times, MC5.
Yep.
MC5.
And that's when I used to play with Billy C and the Sunshine, and later on the Charging Rhinoceros of Soul, and sometimes Carnal Kitchen, my old band. So.
Yeah, would you cheer?
Oh no, I loved it. Yeah. I was into Coltrane and outside music. John Sinclair turned me onto that stuff. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it was like an ad thing.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
Was really happy.
You said Elektra Records. So what, Danny Fields comes to town to sign the MC5? Talk about that.
Yeah, we had a gig at the Union Ballroom. It was us and the Five. And Danny's own words, after he'd seen the show, he got a hold of Jack Holtzman from Elektra and said, "I just saw the best two bands I've ever seen in my life. You got to sign them." So it turned out there was a signing party, and we both signed together at the same time. But in a way, it was kind of sad because it changed the band so much. I believe if we could have hung in there a little longer, being the band we were before Elektra, we might have been able to get away with just being ourselves instead of having to conform to a song with a chorus, a verse, a bridge, a solo, a chorus, a bridge, a verse, and an ending, you know. It wasn't the band we were.
Right. When does Ronnie move to guitar?
Shortly after that, Jim said he wanted freedom from having to play an instrument, so Ronnie Switch took over to guitar.
And Dave went to bass.
Dave went to bass, and Jim was just a wild man, performer, singer.
No more wig?
No more wig, but plenty of other crazy things. Plenty of unique, different. See, that was the whole thing in the beginning, is we loved the MC5, we loved the Yardbirds, we loved the Kinks, we loved a lot of the good rock and roll, a lot of the blues, rhythm and blues, but we just kind of knew we're not going to be able to sound like that. We can't do that. So if we're going to do something, we're going to have to do something that no one can compare it to and say, well, you guys aren't as good as the Yardbirds, you know. So once we knew we had something totally original, we couldn't be compared to anybody else, it gave us a better chance of being our own band.
Okay. Now, Elektra signs you. He wants you to make an album. You guys go to New York to make the album.
Yeah, we went to New York to make the album. And
is that your first time to New York?
First time in New York. They gave us each $1,000.
I went out and bought a leather jacket, a briar, wood hash pipe, and 4 ounces of hash.
Okay. And where'd you stay? Chelsea Hotel?
Yeah, we mostly stayed at the Chelsea.
That was $6 a night back then.
Wow. And John Cale ends up producing the record. Whose idea was that?
That was the label's idea. I think Cale at that time was working as a staff producer for Elektra.
Okay. But you told me you were way into Velvets.
Yeah, I love the Velvet Underground, man. And I was excited to have one of them in the studio. And John Cale was like trying to tell us that we were trying to be the new Velvets. In actuality, we didn't sound anything like the Velvets. But
when you came there, did you do any gigs? Or you just recorded the album?
No, we played a lot of gigs there. We used to do Electric Circus and
Before Connor. You recorded?
Before we recorded, yeah. But we were doing our old Ready, Set, Go material.
Right, not the songs, right? No, they're actually written songs. In the Chelsea.
We came with, I think, 3 or 4 songs to New York.
Which ones?
I think it was Little Doll, 1969, and sure what the other one was, but the rest of them were written in a matter of a couple hours in room 101 at the Chelsea Hotel, a room that became famous later for Nancy Spungen shot, what's his name,
Sid
Vicious, in that very same room. That was the room Jim always stayed in. And then we went in the studio the very next day and never had played the songs live through amplifiers because we were playing them cold. I was beating on a mattress on the bed. Ronnie and Dave were playing electric acoustic. And Jim was just sitting around clapping his hands.
Ah, that's where the clapping comes from.
Yeah. So we went in the studio. So remember what we were playing in the hotel last night? Let's try that. And most of them, like Not Right, we never had played that song. The first time we played it was the actual take on the album. I think we did all the rhythm tracks in 2.5 days and another day and a half for the mix, and we were done.
Damn. Whose idea was the piano note, the dog?
Jim's. That was Jim's idea. We didn't want to use a tambourine, because the problem with tambourine is when you use one, it makes it a tambourine song.
Yeah.
So, and the simplicity of all of it couldn't take more than one note.
Right. Did John Cale have ideas for you?
He played his violin on We Will Fall. He played very moving, very nice piece at the end of that.
Yeah.
I thought he did a really excellent job.
How'd you come up with that? Dave had something to do with that, right?
Well, yeah. Dave was a reader. He would read all these books. He would buy everything that was out of the normal books. He read a lot. And he had bought a book of chants and what each particular chant was to do. And it was the Raja Jara Jara. That particular chant was, I think, to bring peace of mind. And if you hum, say those words enough time, you actually do start to feel something. You start to feel like you're drifting in outer space.
Whoa. We've never gotten to do that song.
No.
Or Anne.
We were thinking
play everything off the first two albums except those two songs.
Yeah. It was considered at one point in time.
Yeah?
I think it was for Hammersmith or something. They were thinking about putting it in there.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so you record the first album. Did you think about tour?
Oh, yeah, that's all we did. We all crammed into a van and drove all over the Midwest, all up and down the East Coast. And we did fly out to California. And we do Minnesota, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston. We played Boston a lot, actually.
This is all 1969.
Yeah, all 69. Because our manager was a macrobiotic fanatic, because he was a fanatic. And there was a big macrobiotic community in Boston. So he always wanted us to be in Boston so he could go see Michel Cushy and all the strict macro heads. I learned a lot from Jimmy Silver. Jimmy Silver taught me a lot about a lot of things. He introduced me to jazz. He introduced me to healthy ways of diet. He introduced me to the philosophy of yin yang, which I still use this day. And yeah, we toured a lot. Virginia.
What was those gigs like?
Most of them were
different than the earlier Michigan ones, right?
Yeah, most of them was hostile type crowds. That was like, you know, here's the geek at the carnival, you know, let's jeer at him, you know. But those same people would show up the next time we played. You know, that was the funny thing. And then we started getting a following of loyal fans. But they were loyal fans that kind of came to see us because they didn't really like us. But they wanted to see it anyhow because everything was different. They knew when they saw us again, it wasn't going to be the same thing they saw before.
Right.
So it made it interesting, made it fresh. And then later on, we started getting more dedicated fans. You know,
well, 1970 comes. Time for a new record?
It's time for a new record, and we moved houses. We had a really nice house. Everyone had their own apartment. It was a huge old farmhouse. We had our equipment set up in the living room of the house. And
this is in Ann Arbor.
We would play every day, you know. Every day we were home, about 3 in the afternoon, we'd all get together, we'd all go in, we'd all kick around ideas and play till about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. We did that every single day. So we started coming up with like
a new batch
of stuff that was tighter and more worked out, different energy than the first album. They sent us off to L.A.
Well, I was going to get to you. Steve's brought in, right? While you're at this house, right?
Yeah.
Yep. No, I was working at Discount Records, and I knew Jim. I didn't really know you guys, but I knew Jim, and him and Ben Edmonds were sitting across the street in a cafe, a diner, whatever it was, and he came over and he says, "Can you take a break now? I want to come over and we want you to come over and talk to us." And he came over and he says, "Well, I've heard your band Carnal Kitchen." He was actually, the first time Carnal Kitchen played was in 1970, I think, at some art school function called the Beaux-Arts Ball. And I think Commander Cody was the headliner on that one. I think I played with all three bands that night.
Steve never got off the stage.
Yeah. But I remember being impressed by the fact that Jim was sitting in the front row watching us. And he must have liked what he heard. And he said, "Well, come on over to the house tonight."
Yeah, so you bring him over to the house.
So come over to the house, and he comes up with the guys come up with Funhouse. And I, you know, play my weirdness on top of it. And they said, "Oh, that's good." And then 1970, I played on that one. And then I ended up playing like
L.A. Blues.
Yeah, and L.A. Blues. Well, we named it that later, yeah. It was used to be called the hippie ending.
But you're working out the songs at the house, but then the plan comes to go to L.A.
And I I played 2-3 shows with him, and then the roadies came in to the record store and said, "Aren't you excited, Steve?" And I said, "Why?" He says, "Because you're going to L.A." And I says, "Geez, nobody ever told me that." About a week later, Jim calls me and says, "Well, you're going to L.A." So I was still going to college then, so I had to like blow off one of my final exams and stuff.
Whose idea was L.A., Scott?
It was a record label I did, and they had Don Bellucci out there.
Gallucci, yeah.
And they wanted him to do it, and that's,
the guy that used to be in Don and the Good Times, and
Kingsman.
And he produced Louie Louie when he was 14 or something. And he wanted the live sound, and so and it was like people didn't do that then. It was all, even then on 8-tracks, it was you know, overdub city, you know.
The coffee machine gun. So you go to out to LA. You set up the studio like a gig.
Yeah, we all played live in the same room. Steve played live, Jim sang live. There was no separation. You know, it was
a little PA.
PA was right there, and we were playing like we played in our living room back home.
Right, the farmhouse.
Yeah,
it was a huge house, and it had like separate apartments in it. So Ronnie had his place, and Jim had like the one way up in the top floor. And I don't know if I ever visited Scotty's apartment, but someone had written on the wall, because people wrote on the walls there, somebody had written on the wall, "Fun House."
Ah, hence the title.
Yep.
Okay, so you come out to L.A. How long did it take to make the record?
Well, we took a little more time with that, because
you have the songs together this time.
We have the songs together. We're still actually kind of rehearsing in the studio. On that box set, you can see how we
sure
half songs, do a whole track, do it again, it sounded totally different. So we're still kind of like playing with them. But they were more worked out than the first album was. And like, Funhouse was actually inspired by James Brown. It's kind of that funky off syncopated snare chop.
Yeah.
But, you know, we put our own stuff to it. And I think when we were working up that is when we were all hearing a saxophone in there.
Oh, so you're talking.
We're all hearing a saxophone.
Yeah.
And it just seemed fitting. And, you know, the band, you know, we thought kind of needed something. And we just thought the sax would be perfect. And Steve was the man. He was probably the best and most well-known horn player in town at that time. So it's just naturally to go to Steve. And we're sorry about you missing your exams.
Well, that's all right, because I got to take the exam later on in some library, and the guy gave me a softball question to write an essay about. And so I did really well. But then when it came time to go back to school in the fall, I said, the art school was on my case. They were like, "We see what you're trying to do, Renaissance man. You got to decide whether you want to be an artist or a musician."
Right.
And so I...
they're getting good. Because they're back.
I dropped out of college, which of course made me eligible for the draft, and then I had to come up with my I'm crazy scam to get me out of that.
Oh yeah, but you guys all had something like that, right?
Jim was first.
Everybody got letters, right?
Jim was first, Ronnie was second. I was the last to go. You're supposed to register on your 18th birthday. I registered on my 19th birthday. And at that time, it was the peak of the war. More soldiers were dying. The battles were heavier and thicker in the whole Vietnam War.
Well, we had a lottery with a number system.
My number was 44.
Yeah, mine was 149. And when I went in for my physical, they were at 125, and it was June. And little did I know that they weren't going to go past 125. So I, made sure I was pretty debilitated and had a letter too. So.
But what'd you do to run the hustle?
Well, there was this band out of New York called David Peel in the Lower East Side. and their logo was a skull and crossbones.
Pirate
thing. And they had big badges that they were handing out. So I wore the same clothes for 2 weeks, slept on the practice room floor, didn't shower, didn't wash my hair. Just went around about my daily, everyday business, but just getting myself as dirty as I possibly could. And I took some lipstick and I put like Indian war paint on my face.
And, this is getting ready for the draft.
Getting ready. So I got a ride down there. I missed the bus because you're supposed to take a bus. I got someone to drive me down there. And I walk in. I drank like 2 quarts of beer on the way down there. It was early in the morning. I got there. I was pretty broch. And I was late. So I was behind the whole schedule. The written tests. Then the physical exam. Everyone already was ahead of me, so I was in the exam room, written test by myself. So there was a fan in the corner, so I went and I got this fan and I drug it across the room and I put it right aimed on my desk. My papers are blowing all over the place. And I started with question number 1. That's easy. I marked the wrong answer. Question number 2. I know that. Wrong answer. So when the questions started getting harder, I would just like try to pick out which one I think was wrong and check it. So about halfway through the test, all of a sudden, I started spinning a little bit. The next thing I know, I was hurling all over the place. So they came in, took my uncompleted test with hurl, and took me straight to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist had this big desk and he had all these little knickknacks and trinkets and little toys all over his desk. And he's asking me questions and I really couldn't help it. I was picking up things off his desk and looking at him and he'd say, "Don't touch that, put that down." So he'd ask me another question and I'd try to start answering him and I would just pick something. I wasn't trying to. I'd pick something else up and start looking at it. And he'd go, "Put that down." So then he calls in a sergeant, staff sergeant, and he says, "Take this guy to the station. No, never mind. Just get him out of here." So they walked me to the front gate, opened it up, pushed me out the gate of the fort, and closed it behind me. And there I was, in Detroit, in a semi-not greatest neighborhood. So I went to this bar. It was only about 9 o'clock in the morning. So I went to this bar and I realized I forgot to bring a dime for a phone call to have someone pick me up. So I stumbled in this bar and there's the old neighborhood people that start drinking in the morning. And I'm trying to borrow a dime. They're all looking at me like I'm from outer space because I'm forgetting what I've actually looked like.
I had the
lipstick on my face and shit. The skull and crossbones, puke, and I stunk like hell. And the people were just like turning away from me. So I went and I sat down in a booth and I ordered a glass of water because I had any money. And I was underage anyhow. So I laid my head down on the bar, man, and I just was passing out. I couldn't stay awake. The bartender woke me up, told me I had to leave. Next door to the bar, there was a church. Had long steps leading up to the front door of the church. I walked up about halfway up the stairs and laid on the stairs and fell asleep. Next thing I know, there's 2 cops with their sticks poking me in the ribs going, "Get up, get up, get up." I explained to them I'd just come from the fort. I didn't have any money. They said, "You're a vagrant," so they ran me in. They threw me in jail. So I went to jail and I slept there for a while and I woke up and started realizing, well, I haven't had a phone call. Nobody knows I'm here. They're probably all wondering where the hell am I. It was about 10 o'clock at night by then. So I'm yelling, I need a phone call. I'm sticking my head through the bars. I didn't get a phone call. I didn't get a phone call. So there was a shift in the duties. And the new guys came in. I could see the new guys coming in. So when I saw one of them, said, hey, I never got a phone call. He goes, you didn't. So he let me out, and I called Bill Cheatham. He came and picked me up. I had to go back to court. $50 fine for being a vagrant. And it was a couple weeks later, I got a 1Y deferred, which means in a case of natural disaster or a case of a big war, I could be called up to go. I also had a fractured spinal disc that I got records from the hospital. So I think that had a big part of it, because I would have been a guy, my first, second week in boot camp, I would have thrown my back out. The government would have been paying for my back for the rest of my life. So I think that one of the reasons they cut me loose is because of my back.
Well, so then you got excused from class.
That's good. See, I've heard a few stories from you. I never heard that one. That's one of the best get out of the Army things. The MC5 used to have this kind of priest's robe, and they called it the Zenta robe. And when each of them would go down, they'd go down separately, they would be naked underneath the Zenta robe, and they'd say, I'm a high priest of Zenta. And that's how they got out.
And what'd you do?
I had a letter from a psychiatrist. I think I was psychedelicized. I hadn't slept in a couple of days. And I read this wonderful book called 4F that let you know all of the forms you were going to have to fill out. And the first form you fill out, you answer all the questions, and they said, don't answer the last three questions. So, of course, I answered them. It's like, are you a drug addict? Are you a homosexual? It's like, much respect to gay brothers and sisters, but I wasn't. But they weren't buying that either. And they said, I'd gone to this psychiatrist who was a homosexual, as it turned out. But he wrote me a letter, and I ended up with the 1Y.
Okay.
And by the time they got back around to me, as it turned out, I had to fill out a form for the FBI and everything, too. It says, oh, yeah, play music for the White Panther Party and stuff like that.
Oh.
So I've probably still got a file on me somewhere.
Okay. Well, that's the end of the second hour of the Watt from Dudro Show, March 7, 2007. Hold tight for hour 3. March 7, 2007. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Now, what we got to continue here is, how did Ronnie and Iggy get out of it, going to the war?
Well, Ronnie's got his own story, but what I remember is that he hyperventilated for hours. He worked himself into this state that just taking a look at him, you go, something's wrong with this guy. So they thought he was on drugs, so they kept him overnight.
Well, that's what happened to me. They said, we can keep you overnight, and they did, and I'm glad they did. I said, you can keep me for a couple of weeks if you want to. I just don't want to go in your damn army.
Yeah. So, Ronnie, I think he said he stayed up all night, continued hyperventilating, and then by the morning he was shaking. And they became kind of afraid. Well, is this guy going to, like, die or something? We better get him out of here. So then it was the next day they cut him loose with a 4F.
Wow. That was the supreme prize.
What about
the 4F?
Well, what I remember, what I know of his story was that he made it through the written exam. He was to the physical part, to where you're stripped down and marched through a line, and guy grabs your nuts and tells you to turn your head and cough. They took one look at him, they yanked him out of the line, and I think he got a 4F also.
But you all got out. Now, you come to L.A. Where were you staying while you were recording the record?
I was staying at Tropicana on Santa Monica Boulevard.
I think it's a Marriott now or something.
Yeah, half a block down from La Cienega.
Yeah.
A block down parallel from Sunset Strip. It was just, to this day, some of my favorite, best memories of my whole life was being there, recording that album. staying at the Tropicana, being able to walk up to the strip, cruise the strip.
Well, walk to the studio, too.
Yeah, and we walked to the studio.
Was that your first time to Cali?
First time to Cali. I loved it. And to this day, it's still some of my best memories. I just had a blast out there. I loved every minute of it.
How long were you guys there?
About 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
Well, that included several gigs at the Whiskey A Go-Go, and then also taking a side trip up to San Francisco to play at the Fillmore with the Flamin' Groovies, Alice Cooper, and Commander Cody.
Wow.
That was a good game.
And you're doing sessions, though, too.
Yeah.
For the album. What was it like working with Gallucci?
I don't know. He seemed like, this little kind of strange guy to me. But, you know, to me, I wasn't working with him. He was working for us, you know,
yeah.
So I never really looked at, I never thought about, oh, who's a good producer, who's better, this, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was mostly just in the music, mostly in my instrument, and just playing. I didn't think about things like that at all.
Did he tell you anything?
He was telling other people things, you know, but to me, again, you know, it meant nothing to me. It could have been anybody in there.
You guys were running your own show.
Him being Don Gallucci didn't mean anything to me.
He let us be ourselves, yeah. He also...
How long were the sessions? Were they long ones?
We'd go in at probably around noonish and stay until early evening.
I was always the first going in there because I mostly had nothing to do. And you guys were always a little kind of late. We'd go for several hours. I mean, that's, if you listen to the box set, you can hear, you know, 32 takes of Down on the Street. And then also there was like... the songs we didn't remember doing that ended up in the box set, which is like
Slide in the Blues
and Lost in the Future.
Yeah, Lost in the Future. You never really did those live, huh?
Oh, no.
No.
When we went to New York, we also did another one called Going Down to Egypt, I think. It was the only encore we ever did.
Oh. Were you playing songs from the album during these gigs?
You were basically doing the album.
You were doing the album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like playing the Whiskey in those days?
Well, we weren't playing the Whiskey in those days.
No, when we were doing the album, we did the Whiskey.
Yeah, Whiskey came on a little later, though.
No, it was the same trip. I remember.
I mean, there's later Whiskey, too.
Yeah, I didn't. The only time I played the Whiskey was during the sessions.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was when Pop went out in the crowd and poured the hot wax on his chest. And
okay, so you get the album done, and you deliver it to Elektra. What do they say?
I think they were thinking it was better than the first album. And they tried to get behind it a little more. Still not with great support. But
they had a gatefold. The sleeve.
Yeah.
But, do you remember taking that picture?
Yeah, I remember perfectly taking that picture.
Yeah.
The photographer, as a matter of fact, was the guy who did all Jimi Hendrix photos.
Wow.
And he was kind of famous. And
Ed Kareff.
Yeah. And
who may still be alive.
And the photo session was kind of long. It took a lot of pictures.
It's in the studio.
And about every 10 minutes, the photographer disappeared to the bathroom.
What's that about?
And we're going, what's up? Is he sick? So as it turns out, he was doing blow.
He's George.
And I didn't even know what the hell it was. What's he doing? He's doing cocaine. I said, oh. And then later on, he offered us some. I never had that stuff before. Sure, I'll try.
So the first time is that photo session. Is that what the studio looked like when you were recording?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the famous thing in Elektra's ads at the time. They would show this the empty studio with the Persian rug on the floor.
Yeah.
So then in the album. album was that the four guys in the band, they Elektra didn't want to use my picture.
Who did the cover?
Well,
pictures from that photo session.
Bill Heimal, I think, was the art director.
I've got good memories.
Yeah, he was the art director at Elektra. I think he probably did that montage.
Took pictures from the session in montage.
Yeah.
Dave's got the trippiest eyes on that thing. They're like you could jump into them.
Yeah.
They're so huge, so deep.
Yeah. Some people swore they saw my picture on the cover buried in the thing, but
yeah.
No.
No, you're not.
No, there's a picture of me on the. The bonus track Funhouse that came out a couple of years ago, and it's got the same color values and stuff, and it has this thing like not a stooge.
Oh, yeah,
but
right.
But it's a picture of me at age 20, and that was quite something to see.
All right. Can we talk about the songs? Like Down on the Streets.
Yeah, Down on the Street was like we did most all of our songs. We'd kick them around in the practice room. Then if we all heard something that we thought might be able to work with, then we start concentrating on that. It became that riff.
Right.
And Dave learned it easy on bass, so that was another reason we did it. Jim put the words to it. It was down on the beach, and I'm floating around, and I'm real mind. There ain't no walls. I'm going, yeah, that's cool, but, you know, the beach, you know, we're not really looking for the beach kind of scene, you know. What's better, what's tougher, what's cooler is the street. You know, that's where you're going to find people that would like us. They're not going to be on the beach. They're going to be in the street. And so he goes, oh, that's not a bad idea. So instead of changing all the lyrics, all from Down on the Beach, went to Down on the Street.
Right. Now, the real old mine.
That was an Ann Arbor expression.
Yeah.
And that's also accompanied by putting your hand on top of your head and flipping it up and
right,
down.
Right.
And we tried to figure out the origins of that. It might be, oh, the mind or something like that. But it was an expression that many of us used during that time.
Out of your mind.
Well, it was shortened. It up. I think maybe we started it because it was out of sight, out of mind. And instead of saying out of sight, out of mind, we just go, oh my.
Yep. But everybody in Ann Arbor started saying it too.
It's kind of a mental state.
Yeah. Kind of. I think I've been oh mind ever since.
Real old mind.
Now,
real old mind.
What about Loose?
Loose is the same thing, something we kicked around the studio. And Jim put excellent lyrics to it. And,
not in the farmhouse, but in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had,
no, they had all that stuff together before we went to L.A.
Okay. 1970 we had together. The only thing we didn't have together was L.A. Blues.
Okay.
We had Dirt and all that stuff.
Had Dirt.
But Loose, you know what's a trip about Loose? Is that riff ended up in a Deep Purple song called Smoke on the Water.
Yeah, I did.
You ever notice that?
Close.
I mean, you guys are before them.
Yeah, close to, yeah.
What's that? But Ronnie probably made up the way the chords slide up and down the
neck.
And Dirt, I remember saying, well, we need a soul song, and I want to use this beat. Boom, bop, bop, boom, boom, bop.
It's sort of a surf beat,
so
backwards.
I started playing that beat. Dave came up with the bass part. Boom, 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 boom.
Which was sort of like Born Under a Bad Sign.
And then Ronnie put a guitar to it, Jim put the lyrics to it. That's all Dirt. Dirt.
What about TBI?
TBI, you know, was we were trying to put together an album, so we were trying to think, well, now we need a song that's going to be more down and driving and straight ahead.
Right.
And that particular beat was a really popular Motown beat.
Yeah.
It was used a lot in Motown songs.
Right. Snare on the one.
Yeah. The four-chop snare beat, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, again, we just started with the feel of the beat. And Ronnie was playing ma 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 ma.
What about 1970?
The song 1970.
Yeah. Was it really called I Feel All Right?
No, it was 1970.
Okay. Because the single says I Feel All
Well,
Right.
Well, they added that.
Is that the record cover?
Because that
it says 1970.
I Feel All Right.
I Feel All
Right. Right, right.
So people could recognize the hook in the song or something.
Okay. Okay. Was there any singles from the first album?
Yeah, I Want to Be Your Dog in 1969, I think.
It's double-sided. It was a single, both sides for Dog.
I think I've got a scratchy copy of that somewhere, actually, yeah.
But 1970 was a single from 70.
I mean, on the Street and 70.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, and that's, I made it on the B-side of that one. They took the razor blade to my solo quite adeptly. But I also was like double track. They called me in for a second session to overdub. And ended up using both of them.
At the same time.
Which is sort of reminiscent of the new album with Fried.
Right,
where they had like three tracks.
Composite. And then L.A. Blues is the one that's...
Well, we always had a thing we'd call Freakouts, which was just total play whatever you want.
Right.
Not a song. Play your drum chops. Play wild solos. Steve blew really good sax on it. I guess it was just as free fun as you
could. Well, Gallucci said, rather than have an extended ending to Funhouse, which is used to be the last song, and then we'd go into this ending, he says, make a separate song out of it. So that was when we had a separate session just to do that song, to sort of start cold with that song.
Yes.
That was the one where I made sure I was pretty psychedelicized when I went into the studio to do it. I think I ended up getting real scared of Jim. And it kind of comes out on the music, but they, you know, it worked out.
Now you deliver the record, the company likes it. He's going to go
tour it hard, East, West Coast, all through the South, all the Midwest.
That was
now
that,
were those gigs different than the first album gigs?
Yeah, they were mustard. More people knew who we were getting better bills, more money, and
playing in New York and celebrities coming to see us,
yeah,
and stuff.
Lots of New York.
Is that the Maxis?
Maxis.
No, it was Unganos.
Unganos, Maxis, Electric Circus on St. Mark's Place. There was a really cool venue called Electric Circus.
So they're a lot different. And then what happens?
Then what happened was,
you got scissors?
Oh, I got scissored after 6 months, and Jim says, well, I want to do something else, and, you know, at that point in time, I was thinking about quitting, but I wanted to get out of the nightmare the band had become because of substance abuse. And we were, you know, being late for all the gigs and stuff. And like when your snack dealer drives you to the gig in his limousine, you know, something's is like, well, this isn't exactly right. And so,
6 months of touring, you're out.
And they let me go. And Jim called me on the phone, fired me over the phone, and I was so happy. I called up my boss at the record store. I said, could I have my job back? He says, come on in tomorrow. And you know, still remain being friends with Jim. And I said, you know, no hard feelings. Yeah, yeah.
But you guys keep playing.
You keep playing. This is where James came into the picture. Because the band did actually break up. The band actually did break up for a while. And Steve wasn't the only one just cut loose. Everybody was cut loose.
Well, but isn't Dave? Yeah, Dave.
But we still had our house.
Dave was the first one to get fired.
Yeah. He gets cut before you.
Yeah.
Goose Lake?
We still had our house. We still had our house.
Right, what
we
happened to Goose Lake?
Well, Dave had a girlfriend whose father was a pharmacist, and she worked part-time with her dad in the pharmacy. And While she was there, she'd always be grabbing handfuls of pills. So Dave had been drinking before the show, and she gave him a quaffle right before stage. He got up there. He couldn't even hardly hold his bass.
This is in front of over 100,000 people.
He couldn't play the songs, and what he was trying to play sounded so bad. One of the crew guys went up, turned his amp off, and he didn't even know it was off. That's how fucked up it was. So we finished the rest of the set without any bass. People went absolutely crazy, man. They went nuts. It was the first time people tried to storm the stage. They had a 12-foot fence between the crowd and the stage. People were crawling over that 12-foot fence.
To get to it.
To get to it. It was the third day of the festival.
Well, everybody was really fried. Well, another thing that happened during that set was it was later on in the set, and it was during the point in time where I was playing. I think we were doing 1970 or something, and we blew out the power.
Oh.
And so it was just me and Scotty playing acoustically. And
for 100,000 people.
But then what happened, I heard this from people in the crowd, this from people that were in the crowd that were all tripped out. The sound came on all of a sudden, and they heard this insane drums and saxophone, and then the guitar started playing again. And it was so out there that people literally started freaking out.
Okay.
You know, having a bummer, as we used to say.
So Dave gets replaced?
Dave got replaced by Zeke Zittner.
The roadie?
He was one of the crew guys, yeah.
You're playing with him with Zeke?
Yeah.
Then you leave?
Yeah.
Then you do gigs with just Zeke, you, your brother?
No, we had no gigs.
Oh, after Steve's
was
over.
And after Steve's was over, we still had the house and we still had our equipment. So Jim wasn't even in to practicing, so I got Zeke and myself in the practice room. And one other guy, Bill Cheadle. And I said, I'm starting a new band. It's going to be called Rock Action. And these are the songs we're going to do. We wrote 5 songs.
Well, see, I remember before I got fired, I remember it was originally called the Rock Active Band. Yeah. And it was because...
So Rocked After,
yeah. We basically had a different band in the house.
Who's playing in it? Bill Cheatham?
Bill Cheatham, Zeke, and myself.
Okay. It's a trio.
Well, there's a song called I'm Becoming an Alcoholic. I remember that one.
I was writing all the lyrics, all the songs. One was I'm Becoming an Alcoholic. One was Out on the Range. It's out on the range where things are sometimes strange. I don't think I'll ever be the same. Out on the range. And the alcoholic was, I drank a case of beer, I smoked an ounce of head. No, I was still out on the range.
So what happened after that?
We did had a little cover of
gigs?
The song Peter Gunn. We did a little different version of Peter Gunn, and I called it Peter Scott Has Gunn. And, you know, some of the songs were bad, you know, they were okay. And then Jim wanted to get the band back together. So that's when James Williamson, who moved from Birmingham into Ann Arbor, he was a hot guitar player. He kind of slid into the picture. We got him over the house one day. He started kicking around shit in the practice room. And,
both Jim and Ronnie on guitar.
Both him and Ronnie on guitar.
Who's on bass? Zeke?
Zeke's on bass. And that didn't last too long.
Any gigs?
We did some. We did New York gigs, Electric Circus. I think we did Max's. And then that was over. And then Jim left the country. The house was gone. It was being torn down. They built a bank in its place. And so then again, we're homeless and no band. And
So it's back to mom's house.
Right.
Yeah,
where's he? He's in England?
Yeah. And he took James with him. They went to England. And Jim got a record deal. And one day he called us up and said, we're trying to do an album. We can't find any players. We've auditioned 50 different guys, and we want you and Ronnie to come over. But we want Ronnie to play bass. And, you know, being a musician, you're out of a gig. Yeah, I'll take it. I want a gig. You know, so that's the way Ronnie felt. He wanted a gig, and he was willing to play bass.
I'm a bass player. Sounds like he was demoted.
Well, he
did.
Felt,
he feel that way?
He did. He felt like he was demoted. But I tell you, Ronnie was excellent bass
player. Yeah, I think so.
Well, he plays the bass on the Stooges stuff on Skull Rings.
What's funny is he started out on the bass. So you guys go to England.
Well, actually, he started out playing guitar, but his experiences in bands were with the bass.
I thought he was playing the wow-wow and the fuzz.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm talking about when he was younger.
Okay.
He his Spanish guitar, flamenco type stuff, and classical guitar.
Right.
He had lessons in that. I had lessons in snare drum and harmonica. I actually played harmonica for a while.
So you guys go to England, and that becomes the Raw Power.
That becomes the Raw Power.
Now they have the songs, and they're showing you the songs.
No, we kind of work them out there. James, just like we normally do, we'd kick around, and there'd be a riff, and we try to build a song off of that. You know, put some verse and bridge solos in between the beginning and the end. And, but they were all James's riffs. They weren't Ronnie's riffs.
Right. Now you do a gig over there.
We did a gig.
Is that during the sessions?
At the Roundhouse with Lou Reed. And, we freaked England out so bad they didn't know what to think. They didn't know if they liked us or not. And for a long time, consensus was they didn't like us.
But you only played the one gig.
One gig.
Then you go back and you finish the record.
We did the record. We went back to California.
Right.
They set us up in a big house in the Hollywood Hills, top of Laurel Canyon.
This is the Bowie people.
Yeah. And we spent a lot of time there just going to the rehearsal studio, coming back and having a party. We'd have a party every night. We weren't doing that many gigs. And on top of that, all the bad things were starting to compound, get worse and heavier.
Yeah.
So then we found, well, we got some gigs. We got a tour around the road.
Because the album comes out.
And we go, well, wait.
What did the record company take of Raw Power?
They weren't sure. They didn't know what to do with it. They never heard anything like it. They didn't know how to promote it. They didn't know how to book us. You know, they didn't know anything.
You did a lot of whiskey gigs.
We did a lot of whiskey gigs because we were there.
Right.
We played the Starwood. But
to bring in a piano guy.
Right? Is that Scott Thurston?
Thurston and Robert Sheff.
But this is
right.
But this is after the album's done. But this is in California that you bring them in. Right. Whose idea was that?
Well, you know, kind of like the way Steve was introduced to the band.
Yeah.
So we felt that we needed something else besides just guitar, bass, and drum. We needed another instrument in there to fill it in, to give it more of a wall. And well, let's try keyboards.
And Sheff is the first guy.
Sheff was a keyboard player in the Crying Movers.
Right.
He's also currently known as Blue Gene Tierney, and he's a very respected modern composer. And I heard something actually on the radio last week, and I heard this thing with this interesting keyboard stuff with Antoi pianos on it and such. And I said, "Wow, that's really interesting." And then they said it was him. I said, "Oh, that's cool.
Wow. So he only does a few gigs with you, though, right?
Yeah, he didn't do all that much.
And then you bring in Scott Thurston?
Well, Thurston was there. Thurston left. Robert came in. Robert left. Thurston came back.
Oh, okay. Where'd you find Thurston?
On a bulletin board at SIR Studio Instrument.
So you didn't really know him. You just answered an ad.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. You're doing these gigs. Do you tour a lot?
Well, you know, the record label didn't really know what to do with it at that time. We weren't touring that much.
Yeah.
That was what the worst thing was for the band.
You're just staying in Hollywood and playing these gigs
all
local.
All the idle time. All the girls out there with their purses loaded with drugs. And, you know, just too much free time.
Yeah.
It's the same thing we had with the first two albums. The record company didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know where to put us. Who's going to like these guys?
At least you were torn with that, those records.
Yeah. But we weren't getting the support.
Yeah, I understand.
We weren't getting enough support from the record label itself.
They're dumb fucks.
Yeah, they were dumb fucks.
Okay. So what happens? Idle time just destroys the band.
Idle time basically destroyed the band, and there was this thing Bowie had going on with his guitar player Mick Ronson.
Yeah,
they were trying to make those two guys like stars. So James saw that. Well, me and Iggy could do this, and this is James that was invited into the Stooges. Now wants to take over the Stooges.
Bum rush.
He wants to make me and Ronnie sidemen, and him and Jim the leaders of the band. So he had a girlfriend that was a contract lawyer, and one day he came up with this thick fucking contract saying me and Ronnie were sidemen, we get paid less, he'd get the lion's share with him and Jim. And we just looked at, me and Ronnie looked at each other and go, fuck that. You know, this is our band. We started it. Yeah. This guy's going to come in and try to push us to sidemen? So no fucking way. And we had no gigs in. We had no shows in. Up at the house one day, someone who worked for Main Man caught Jim with a needle in his arm. Flip. Totally went crazy. You guys are done. You're finished. Next thing you know, your house in the Hollywood Hills is gone. Get up. So we went down to the strip area, and we found Howard's weekly rental place we were staying. And Ronnie had a friend from Ann Arbor that moved out there that was supporting him, and they got an apartment at the Coronet on the strip next to the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And I had no place to go. I was sleeping on anyone's floor or couch I could, just every day going someplace different.
Where's your drums?
The drums are at the airport in storage.
Damn.
And so Ronnie decides he's going to start another band. You know. So he got Dennis Thompson to come out from Detroit, and Jimmy Recca to come out from Detroit to play bass. And this guy, John Riley, who was backing the whole thing, was, you know, supporting them to get them started as a band. And here I am, nowhere. And one day I went over to Ronnie and said, Ronnie, can I sleep behind your couch?
Behind it, not on it.
Behind it. And he goes, yeah, but not for long. You can stay, but not for long. So I think I stayed about a week, and he was saying, you gotta go.
Scissors.
I had no money. I had no job. I had a drug habit. I was in a really bad place. So I was just, I was at a loss for what I could do. So I remembered I had a drum kit at the airport. So I got it arranged to have it picked up. I went out there. We had to pay a storage fee. I got the kit. I brought it back. Dennis Thompson just came to town. He had no drums. I sold him my drum kit. I bought a one-way ticket to Detroit.
see it.
Whoa.
See, this is important because people ask why we don't do raw power songs.
Well, because one, Ronnie won't do them, and the other is James claimed all the publishing rights to the songs. So that's two reasons not to do them right there.
It's a different
I wouldn't
band.
Mind doing them. I like the songs. Yeah, yeah. You know, I would do them, but it's a different band. Yeah.
So you go back to Ann Arbor.
I go back to Ann Arbor and I lay around licking my wounds and sick of drugs. I want to quit. I'm not going to do this anymore. I cold turkey myself. It took me 2 years before I started feeling normal. I didn't go to any doctors. I didn't go to any psychiatrists, no support groups. I just did it all on my own. Made up my mind, I was done, it was finished. And that was in 75. That's when I quit.
Wow. But then you start playing again. Scott Morgan.
No, actually, I knew this guy, Lance Louis Long.
What a guy.
Yeah.
Rest his soul.
Yeah. And
good cat.
He had a tree outfit where, you know, where he cut trees down. And I saw him one day. He goes, I'm going to get you out there to show you what work is. And that's the kind of guy he was, you know. He called me Snotty Scotty. Come on, Snotty Scotty, I'm going to show you what work is. So he did. He got me out there, worked my ass off.
Sawing trees.
Sawing trees, man. Humping asses and elbows. That's what he'd say. I want to see a lot of asses and elbows out there. So he had a little drum kit and his amp set up in his garage. So after work, we'd stop at McDonald's, get a burger, he'd buy us a six-pack of beer, and then he'd go, all right, motherfucker, now get your ass out there in that garage. Start playing those drums. Okay. So it was actually Lance Louis who got me back up going and playing. Okay.
Right.
And I thanked him many times. I'm glad I got a chance to thank him for it. And then one day Fred Smith came by Scott Morgan.
Because the MC5 had broken up for quite a while.
They had the Scott Morgan band. Fred was playing with that band. But Fred took over that band and changed it to Sonic's Rendezvous.
Right.
So he wanted me to be the drummer in the band, and I'm kind of hemming on around and said, okay. And I was really, really glad I did that, because Fred, man, it was just nothing like playing with Fred. First time I played with Fred, the only thing I could think of is, now I know why they call him Sonic.
Yeah.
He had just this power in his guitar, man. It was just unreal.
Yeah.
And you did gigs.
Oh, yeah, we did gigs.
You recorded?
We recorded. We had enough songs for two good albums.
And what happened?
Fred just didn't want to get in the studio. Fred really felt that more people that heard his songs, the more chance he had of getting his material ripped off.
Oh.
He just felt really protective of his material. And he didn't think we were ready. But towards the end of that band, we were getting really good. People were really starting to like it. It was getting tight. And it was sounding good.
Now this is what? 76?
No, this is 80s.
Oh, really? Because before that, you toured with him.
Yeah.
With Fred.
We had the band.
Right.
And then Jim asked if Fred,
78.
Myself, and Gary, without Scott Morgan.
Gary Rasmussen.
Gary would be his band on a tour he had set up of Europe. And it was a big one, too. A lot of shows. And so we negotiated a little deal, price deal, and weekly salary thing, and we went out on the road with them. After that tour was over, Jim was friends with David Bowie, and he came up to me and says, me and David want you to go up and spend some time with us in the country. You know, Jim was going, I want you to come along with us because I want you to be my drummer. And I was kind of afraid, you know. Was, what? Go out in the country with Jim and David Bowie? And then I was thinking, well, we got our Sonic Rendezvous band. You know, I really liked playing with Fred. So I made the choice to go back to America. We continued on with the Sonics band. Started getting better, tighter, more people liking it. And then when that broke up, I tried to get a hold of Jim, and all he could say was, you made your choice.
Oh, it was from that.
You had your chance. You made
your
choice.
To go to the country.
Yeah.
Oh, man. The Sonic Rendezvous band did record, though. Some singles.
We did City Slang.
Yeah.
And
great song.
Electrophonic Tonic. And the song, what was the name of that? One more. It was Sweet Nothing. It's a really good song, but it never got a vocal track on it. And we were doing that when Patty was pregnant with Fred and Patty's first son, Jackson. And Fred was just a nervous dad, and he wanted to play. So we went to Hardy Fields in Detroit on Woodward, way down in the hood with the boarded up windows all over the place. And I recorded City Slang. And soon after that, Patty had Jackson, and I think we went on for maybe 3 or 4 months after that, and then everything kind of fell apart, and then Patty wanted to get back out on the road, so we started doing gigs with her, did gigs with her in Chicago and Ann Arbor and New York. She got pregnant again, and I guess Patty had an idea of having a band themselves. So Fred was doing gigs with Patty. And we were just kind of, see ya.
You kept playing drums?
Yeah, we went back to the Scott Morgan band.
Yep.
Me and Gary and Scott myself. And we had a couple different other guitar players that came in and out. We'd have a new guitar player every couple weeks. We're trying to find somebody. So I did a lot more 3 sets a night gigs with that. And then after years and years of making $30 or $40 a show, you know, I just kind of lost heart of it. You know, I didn't want to do it anymore. So I started getting offers from other players. This one guy, Sonny Vincent from New York, ended up recording 3 albums with him. We did a major giant European tour. And Sonny was a good guy. He's well known. He has no audience in America. He's pretty well known all through Europe, though. And then Dennis Tick invited me to Australia, did an album in Houston, Texas. We took it to Australia, did a tour of the country. And after Dennis Tick, I think I did some shows with the Dark Carnival, which was his brother's band that was after Destroy All Monsters.
Wasn't the Colonel involved? With...
Yeah, Niagara's husband was kind of headed up the show. And it was, well, Scotty, we got 3 gigs in Canada, one in London, one in Toronto, and one somewhere else. And we guarantee you $250 a show if you go on with this. And I was broke. We had, me and Liz had bills that were piling up, and you know, I was landscaping and, you know, doing these $8 and $10 hour jobs and getting nowhere. So I said, yeah, and then at the end of that little Canada tour, man, I said, all right, where's my money? He goes, I lied. He looked me right in the eyes and said, I lied. I got you out here on a lie. You didn't make any money. So I kind of started flipping out. My brother gave me $100 out of his own pocket.
Did you do drumming after that?
I did. I got into a thing doing parties, house parties. You just get a bunch of musicians. You get a case of beer or two cases and get some big fat joints and you get high and half drunk and everybody plays. You know, to me, that was a lot of fun, man. I love doing that to this day, you know. It's just jamming, house parties. Any musician that wants to come by, bring your guitar, you know.
But you keep calling Ig.
Keep calling Ig, keep talking to his manager. And, well, Jim's got a movie with Johnny Depp. He's got a tour of Germany. He's really busy right now, but he's not opposed to the idea.
This is in the 90s.
Yeah, and I come, I started in the 80s.
Like, wow.
89, I got a hold of him, and I said, it's been 20 years since first album. I think it'd be really cool if we could get the band back together and do an album. You know, it's kind of like a reunion. Jim's not into reunions. I said, all right. So I went to New York. Jim was living there. Got a room at Chelsea Hotel. Got in touch with him. We split the cost of a rental studio. We went in there. He was playing guitar. I was playing drums. Kicked around for about 3 hours. He had his little tape recorder. And when we were done with that little session, I said, Jim, what do you think about getting the band back together for a 20-year reunion? I don't want to talk about it. That's all he had to say.
What were you guys jamming?
I would throw out some beats, and he would play guitar to it. And it's our home, boy.
The next time you get called, it's to be on Skull Ring?
No, I kept calling Art.
Yeah?
I kept calling Art, and Art changed his phone number, and I'm going, oh, God, you must be getting sick of me calling him. But he told me later that wasn't the reason his number was changed. So I got his new number, and I kept bugging him. And then the Skull Ring thing came along. And then
now we're talking 2003.
In fact, you were playing with Ronnie and me and Jay Maskus.
Yeah, that's what we did before. Before that, yeah, that's how that whole thing came about. Jay Maskus, Mike Watt, taking Ron Ashton and myself out on the road. Iggy got word, heard people loved it. His very words himself was, "Who is this Jay guy who's stealing my gold?" So, and he also admitted, he goes, if you guys weren't out there and playing and getting some response, that I would probably never done it. But the fact that you were out there. So, I would say Jay Maskus had a big, big part in getting the band back together. I don't know if that's what his intentions were, but that's how
I just get playing with you, like me.
Yeah.
But you get called for the Skull Ring.
Get called for a Skull Rings practice. We went down there, cold.
Florida.
We went in the studio, cold, no material. Started kicking around some things. Okay, play that. We'll play that 8 times. And we're going to play this.
That's me.
Thank you.
Hello.
And did those songs. In one day. Writing, arranging, and recording all in about 6 hours. Never heard him play. I was working them out because they told us we were coming back in 2 weeks to do the tracks that we come up with. So for 2 weeks, every day, for 5-6 hours a day, I'd listen to those tracks. You know, it's coming up with drum chops and different things here and there. We got back down to Miami, and they said, oh, we're going to take the tracks you guys did here. And I just flipped. For weeks in the morning, I'd wake up in a panic. I'm going, no, this can't be true. This can't be right. Because I was looking at it and say, this is one of the most important things I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be back playing with Jim. New material. And to me, it came out so rough and so unrehearsed and so not really sounding like me, myself, sounding like I knew what I was doing, that I was having panic attacks, you know. I felt like I was ripped off. How could they do that, man? How could they just take something like that and put it on the album? So after that, I swore anytime I was in the studio, anything I'd play it like it was the final take. Yeah. Because I wasn't. I was just diddling along, thinking about shit. You know, what could I do here? I wasn't even really playing.
Okay. The Skull Ring record comes out.
People would say.
But is it talking about gigs?
No. It was a project.
Right.
Skull Ring album came out, and all I remember hearing was like, oh, the ones that Ron Scott played on, those are the best tracks on the album. The other tracks on the album were completely produced and tight, and not a beat or note or twang out of tune, and sounded 100% professional. And then here's this kind of half sloppy, like, crap about frying some guy's hair up in an electric chair. And people are going, those are the ones we like. So then one day Art called me up and he goes, well, Scotty, it looks like it's going to happen. Looks like the band's going to get back together and you're going to do a show in California. And I was just, all right, man, after all these years, man, finally. Because the bands I were in were good bands. I liked playing them, but I never felt at home. I never felt like this is the band I belong in. You know, because I started as Stooge, and I always felt that's where I belonged. And then I became a Stooge once again, and it was like I'd been away on a long journey for many years, and then I got to go home and have a big dinner. That's the way it felt to me. You know, it's like, ah, I'm home. Ah, the food is good.
Yeah. Coachella.
Did the Coachella with Mike Watt, who was pretty close to deadly sickness and pulled himself out of it, man. Like a real musician. Did the gig. People loved it. And that was close to 4 years ago.
Yeah, in April.
Yeah.
And we've been doing gigs since.
How many?
75 now.
75.
And then Weirdness album. After 69 gigs. October. Last October.
Yep. October 06.
Now that was pulled together from a bunch of demo songwriting sessions, right?
Yeah, we probably had about 50 hours in kicking around ideas. Jim put them on a small tape recorder.
Mini disc.
And just kept compiling them. And then when the time did come to do an album, he just went through his little catalog, new stuff, and picked out the stuff he thought he could do his best job with. And then we started arranging and fine-tuning of those, but trying not to beat them into the ground. I mean, you know, not to flatline it.
Yep.
Still have interest in it. But we actually, I think, kind of maybe over-rehearsed a little bit. But it came out good. It's different. It's the Stooges. You know, there will be another album. And
it's going to be your first U.S. Stooges tour in many years.
Many, many, many years. Jim was having problems with his U.S. tours. They had to cancel some, lack of attendance.
Now, what's this tour looking like? Almost clean.
Yeah, this tour looks like they want us to do two shows a night. But well, we'll be back, you know. Yeah. We'll be back in America. We'll be back to Japan. Yeah. We'll be back to Athens, Greece. We love the Stooges. Yeah. We're going to Jerusalem.
Serbia.
Serbia.
Poland.
Poland. Back to Sweden.
France.
France, July 3rd.
Hopefully England.
There is one.
Yeah? When?
I don't know the exact date. We have an Ireland in September.
That's right.
We have the Pink Pop in the Netherlands.
Right.
Which is going to turn out to be a really huge show. They're adding some really hot bands on that show. The 3-day festival is going to be really cool.
The biggest difference between a Stooge gig now for you guys and a Stooge gig in the old days?
Well, a lot of it is the more people. And for a while, as we grew, the age of the people that saw us was with us. Now when we do a gig, I'd say 2/3 of the audience is people who weren't born when we had started up. And kids these days look more into the history of music than we did when we were younger.
Yeah.
And they see the Stooges and they go, oh, we know about them. Isn't Jim the Godfather punk?
And they didn't even know some of the songs. No. But once they hear them, since they're such classic songs, they just grab you.
Is there a different dynamic for you guys playing on stage?
There's a different dynamic just because we've aged with our instruments. And a big different diameter is you yourself, Mike Watt. I think you bring a lot to the table, a lot to the stage. Myself personally, I love playing with you.
Amen, me too. Watt's a legend in his own right.
And as I've said in many interviews before, I don't think we could have found a better bass player, a better person to be in the band than Mike.
I agree.
So that brings us up to now. What about you, Steve, after your Stooge days?
Boy, oh boy. Well, let's see. I was still in Ann Arbor, and we did some more Carnal Kitchen. And at that point in time, we were playing like semi-contemporary jazz covers and things like that. Then I got in this band called the Mojo Boogie Band, and we started out as a blues band and ended up as some sort of like Midwest Bob Seger protege type band. And then a lot of stuff went to hell in Ann Arbor because of the drogas and everything. And I beat it out to California in 77. And that was one of the best moves I had ever made. And ended up playing with Commander Cody, who I knew from Ann Arbor. That's why I moved to the Bay Area. I said, I know guys out there. Maybe I can get a job. And I certainly did. And then I did that for a while. And then played with Snakefinger for a while. We did a European tour and 83, and then it also hooked up with Violent Femmes, who were recommended, I was recommended to by a friend back in Wisconsin, and played with them for a couple of years, and I kind of fell into a relationship where the woman I ended up marrying didn't want me touring, and foolish me, didn't bail on that thing when I should have, and spent a bunch of years mostly being an electrician and crawling around attics and basements and learning that trade, and I was pretty good at it, but
still playing the horn.
I was still playing occasionally. The Femmes would come to town, or I'd play this thing and that thing, And I, you know, me and the ex-wife had another version of Carnal Kitchen for a couple of years, and we did you know, as many gigs as we could and play around the Bay Area and Northern California. And then
you and Jay came to town with Ronnie.
And you and Jay came to town with Ronnie, and you know, Ronnie said, "Well, it's not no money for you tonight, but maybe there's something down the road." And boy, he was right. And I don't know, it was like maybe a year after that or something that I got the call from Jim, who I hadn't heard from, you know, or talked to in over 20 years. And he says, "We're doing Coachella, you know. Do you want to do it?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Do you need to rehearse?" I said, "No, I know the material." And we started out with that, and it was like, I hope there's a buzz from this, and then the rest is history, as they say. So I'm delighted to be back on board with this thing, and I'm, like I said, I'm doing the Radon thing in between times. And
how did that happen?
What?
You meeting the Radon guy?
Oh, I was playing. A friend of mine hooked me up with this band called Liquor Ball, and they were like guitar, bass, and drums, but they just improvised, and it was kind of wild and stuff. And so my friend said, "Oh, you should play with these guys," and I did. And the second time I played with them, we were on a bill with this guy's called Temple of Bon Matin, who've got a pretty good reputation in alternative music. And they had a sax player, and I was just going to leave the gig. It's like, okay, that's over, I'm out of here. And they had sax players. Said, "Oh, I guess I better sit in with you guys." And the bass player that night was Scott Neidiger,
the
Radon guy, and then and Vinny from Temple of Bon Matin, and Ed Wilcox, you know, and then followers of music will recognize those names.
Let me take a break.
Yeah.
I got to go download a Brown Buddy.
Yeah, we're almost done.
Yeah. And so then I started going down to the it was also like Kundo Hola and the Beaches, the guy from Czech Republic,
sure.
Camille, and played some house parties in San Jose. And then at one point, Radon flew me up to Portland, and it was like Steve McKay and the Radon Ensemble, and I was like headlining myself. And so this is cool.
I think that's the run of gigs where I see you play with Smegma and Richard Meltzer.
Right, exactly. That was and there was another thing. Richard Meltzer, who was a big fan from way back in 1970, and I hadn't seen him since then. And there he is, little crusty and spouting his foul mouth and over the weird noise that is Smegma. And they actually put out an album called 30 Years of Service, and it's called Smegma with Steve McKay. So I got to get on that and you know, do all that touring in the States and Europe, and hopefully more of that will be coming up in between times. And I'm hoping for all the best. And I was just talking to my wife, Patty, and she's quoting to me from a lengthy and very positive review in the San Francisco Chronicle Sunday magazine. And they had this little man, a little icon, and he's either left his seat, asleep in his seat, looking with interest, or standing up and clapping. And he's standing up and clapping. And they say, like, you know, we haven't lost any of our old fire from the old days, but, you know, the various social commentary and the lyrics and everything, she really, really liked it. Or he, or Jan, since it's probably a guy.
Well, we're at the end of the show, man, and I want to thank you both for talking to me, and especially for letting me play with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure playing with you, and it's a pleasure to be on the air with you. And
yeah.
We'll come back again, we hope.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Mike for having me on the show, and thank all you people for all the good spirit, and knowing that you all love Mike as much as we do. Thank you very much, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Mike.
It's the March 7, 2007 edition of Watt for Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.